and welcome to 10 Very Big Books, a Malazan read-through podcast. My name is Peter Bond, and today on the show, we're talking through Midnight Tides in spoilers and its relationship to the whole series. So we're talking spoilers to the main 10 in that way, so make your decisions as you do. We started the show about 2 years ago, and I think I felt a lot of pressure at that time, and I still feel that pressure because, you know, my other co-hosts haven't read all the books, so I'm often positioned in this way where, like, I'm the one who knows what's going on, or I'm the expert or something. I feel this anxiety, and that's certainly not the case. I mean, especially in this series, people have read the books a lot of times. There's a lot of opinions. A lot of people have a lot of thoughts, you know, and I'm just one person, you know, so sometimes it feels like a lot to bear. But what's been really great is recently, over the past year or so, I feel like there's been more conversation around the books growing, especially on YouTube, and Iskar Jarek was there first, and in some ways, and now in his wake, we have more people coming into the community and sharing their voices and opinions, and it's really great because, as I said, I am just one, and I don't want to take up too much space, so I invited two great Malazan YouTubers on the show. Here today, we have the Counselor of Moonspawn. Welcome to the show, Counselor.
I'm very pleased that I can be here. It's really a great opportunity to get to talk to Malazan fans from all over the world. And yeah, I'm excited to talk Midnight Tides today.
Me too. And on our third member round out of the crew is Ruthann Bad.
Greetings.
Yeah, so today we're just going to, you know, as I said, get situated, talk Midnight Tides and where it falls into the whole series. So, I've been gabbing on for a few months about the book, but let's just kick it off. Counselor, what do you think of the fifth book, kind of about maybe the halfway-ish mark, you know, wherever you want to put it, but it's also the book that kind of introduces, I was going to say the last set of chess pieces, but that's just not true. We keep introducing things, but it's the last major setting, and it's, I feel like after this point, we start pushing towards the finale. So in some ways. So what do you think of Midnight Tides, and what do you think of the book?
So I'd like to go a little bit back in time to when I read Midnight Tides for the first time. So I know that a lot of people are struggling with it a little because you get presented with a whole new cast of characters. And I think the only crossover character is Charles Zengar. I never really had an issue with the new cast of characters because I felt at home on the continent of Leather pretty quickly. And I think Midnight Tides introduces a lot of great new characters. Of course, we have all the Tist-Edur and the Zengar family, especially. Then we have Tehul and Bak, who are absolute legends. And then, of course, the whole kingdom and later empire of Leather. So I always really, really enjoyed that about the book. And also what you've already kind of said is it's the last big storyline that we get introduced to. And it's kind of a little bit of a setup, I think, for the later books. And I think that kind of gives it a little bit of a unique position in the series. So, yeah.
That's an interesting point that it is kind of, I don't know, which some could say is a weakness. In some ways, it is a book about setup. But I do agree with you in that I, for one, have always been thrown off when people say, like, oh, I'm surprised. Like, I don't know, I had a hard time adjusting to the new setting, this type of thing. Because I think for me, I had a really hard time in Garns of the Moon, and then I did better in Deadhouse Gates, the next big setting change. And then I feel like by the time I got to book 5, I was so used to how Erikson was telling stories. I was, like, ready to start, and we started fresh. And I was, like, from page 1, fully in it and fully getting it. So, Ruthann, did you have struggle with the transition? What did you think about the book? Where do you think about this book in the series?
So in general, I've got to admit, this is not one of those books that I've reread several times. I've revisited the Tehul and Bak scenes an infinite number of times, essentially. But as far as some of the major plot points go, I do enjoy the final third of the book, the final act of the book. I find that very enjoyable. And the entire sort of Tist-Edo invasion of the Kingdom of Leather is pretty spectacular when you think about it, with all of these different factions now coming together behind the Edur to overrun the Kingdom of Leather. But in terms of the POV change, I think you're right. in the sense that by the time we get to book five, we are, some of us are seasoned veterans already, and we kind of expect this. However, I do feel that there is a certain sort of, there is a certain segment of the fan base who clearly have a hard time adjusting to it.
Definitely.
So, and the reason for this is not just because it's a new setting, but because it's such a completely different setting, in the sense that it's not like the jump between Deadhouse Gates and Gardens of the Moon, where it is a completely new continent, but we still see remnants of the consequences of Gardens of the Moon play out in Deadhouse Gates. We see the journeys of Kalam and Fiddler and a couple of the rest. But here, we aren't even sure when this happens. All we know is that this happens before we meet Trull in some of the earlier books. But in terms of a timeline, it takes us pretty much a long time before we get a handle on when exactly this happens. And I think that is quite jarring as well.
No, I think you're dead on that. And especially since the only through line, like Counselor said, is Trull. And, you know, I don't know. I like Trull in House of Chains and everything, but it's definitely just like, oh yeah, here's this new dude. He's like sad, got a past and everything. You saw him in the prologue. And now all of a sudden the book's about him. I don't know. I get it. I don't know. Now that you say it, I do somewhat get it, but I love this book a lot. So I feel like I've always been enthused by that element to it, you know?
I think what has been making it a little easier for me was actually the prologue, because we get that little bit of background between Skabandari and Silch's Ruin. So yes, I have mentioned Atist Andi for the first time. Yay.
Yeah.
As it would have been expected from me.
I was just going to say, 5 minutes in and counselors already gushing over Silch's Ruin. Great.
Yeah, no, but the reason why I like this is because it gives us a little bit of context, right? Because we learn that way back in the past, something has been going on, a clash between the Tist Irur and the Tist Andi, whom we already know. So that's also a level of connection to the earlier books. And I like that because I wanted to know what's going to happen now. Is Lich just going to come back? Are we going to get more Andi content? Or how is all of this going to connect? So that has been helping me personally.
And I think that's one of those things where, like, the Eder piece of the whole thing, you know, is kind of an unspoken question throughout the first four. I think there's some mentions to, like, well, what's going on with the Throne of Shadow? You know, this type of questioning. But it's definitely, like, I don't know. Oh, I suppose you see the, you know, the Salandra and Salana. Salandra? Which one's the boat? The boat and the dragon have similar names.
Salanda.
Salanda and Salandra. Anyway, so you see them and you see the killed eater. Anyway, but my main point stands. They're mostly an elusive question in the first four books.
And the corpse that we find in book three, we find the fate of it at the end of book five, that bug sent him to the bottom of the ocean. Because in the third book, there's a conversation between Quickben and Ganos Paran. And Quick Ben's like, oh, this thing's called a Tist Idur. And Ganos Paran's like, what the fuck is a Tist Idur? And Quick Ben has to sort of put it into context for him. And it's only at the very end of book five that we realize that this corpse is the one that was almost beating Tihol to death. And Buck sends him to the bottom of the sea.
I gotta say, I didn't put that together. You know, I remember that scene in Memories of Ice, but I didn't put it together as that dude. So I'm loving the brain melt over here, you know. So here's just a simple question for, let's throw it to you, Counselor. So, you know, the story really, in some ways, although I think the Luther and the Eater stories really are integrated very meaningfully, do you think either one you more meshed with? Because I was really surprised going through it this time. My co-hosts definitely were more interested in the Luther half of it, which for me leaves me out on, I don't know. I just really love the kind of domestic family drama elements and those elements between the brothers in the Eater. So I wonder if one of those two more you gel with.
So in general, I feel like the thing with Erikson's books is that it's always a little hard to decide who to root for. And with Midnight Tides, I found that I have been like, it has been changing a little over the course of the book. So if I remember correctly, especially in the beginning, I was kind of rooting for the Tist Idur a little bit more. And sure. I really found their society and the Sengar brothers really interesting. But then the farther you progress, the more you start to question now, who am I supposed to be rooting for? So it's, I don't know, I can't really answer that question. I think that when I read Midnight Tides for the first time, I was enjoying the Edor storylines a little bit more, but then I enjoyed the Sol storyline of Teal and Bak more than everything else. And I think on reread, I kind of enjoyed both people equally, I guess. So I can't really choose.
No, I do know what you mean. I mean, the Edor are kind of, I don't know, corrupted is seems like a simplistic way to describe it, but I don't know. Maybe you know what I'm getting at. I don't know. Ruthon, what did you think of between the two if you had to pick?
So I think the prologue kind of set up for me this notion that the Edor were somehow going to play an antagonistic role with the betrayal of Silch's Ruin and things like that. So that probably marred my sort of my perspective of the Edor to begin with. And where once you meet Tehol and Bug, once you sort of, at least for me, once I got to experience the pages with those characters, it wasn't even close for me. I was with the Letheri the entire way. I'm not a big fan of Trull, to be honest. I can see why a lot of people like the character, but the whole tragic, noble, pure-hearted, angel, that's not really my cup of tea in terms of the characters that I enjoy. So for me, it wasn't really hard. I was firmly in favor of the hyper-capitalist Letheri Empire rather than these tribal Edor.
Very interesting. But you do touch on something. You know, you use the word antagonistic. And I, I don't know, especially like you're saying, Counselor, sometimes it's hard to use that language when talking about the series, right? Because Erikson sets things up in just a more complicated way a lot of the times. And so that brings me to one time I was talking about Rulad with some people, you know, on the Discord or some forums or something. And I said I think he is the series most sympathetic villain, you know, which I don't want to use, you know, villain is a loaded word, you know what I mean? But I do find I have tremendous sympathy for him, and he is, I don't know, antagonistic. The thing is, I think those words carry a judgment with it, you know, and I don't know. It's, in some ways, Rulad's a pretty bad dude, right?
So I'm extremely judgmental by nature, so yeah, I totally judge Malazan character.
Yeah, I know. And listen, you know, maybe it's all right to judge him. I don't know. I'm just trying over here. Anyway, so what do you? I guess this is all to say. I really love Rulad as a character, and I think his arc in this book is really interesting. But I wonder how you guys feel about how the Edor are tackled in Reaper's Gale. We're going to get to the book when we get to it. But I think this book does such a great job of portraying them as a complicated people. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I think part of me loved this book so much, I was kind of let down because I didn't feel like Reaper's Gale really was the follow-up to this book I wanted it to be.
I'm just thinking. So I, considering the Edor or the Tist or Tist, it's Tist, right? I always say Tist, but anyway.
I always say Tist, but I think it's Tist.
I say Tist, and I will say Tist until I die.
Yeah. I've actually been called out for my false pronunciation, but anyway.
Me too. The pronunciation thing, though, is never, I don't know. Some of my pronunciations are bad. I'll give you that. But like, anyway, continue.
So before we get into the complexity of the Edor, I would just like to mention that I've always felt like the Tist have a tendency of following their leaders. Because if you look at the Andi, they're kind of always doing what Rake wants. Then we have that thing with Skabandari and the slaughter of the Andi, where they just seem to be following Skabandari. I mean, okay, we don't know a lot about that, but still. And then again, we have Hanan Mosak uniting the Edor tribes, and then he is kind of replaced by Rulad. And then they just follow again, and they seem to be a little mindless about that. And the only Edor in Midnight Tides whom we really see question things is Trall Sengar. So I don't know if maybe that's a little bit of a Tist trait, that they just, yeah, kind of give up thinking for themselves and just follow their leaders. And then what I found also really interesting is how quickly the Edur seem to adapt to the Letheri way of living in Reaper's Gale, and you kind of get to see them become corrupted a little bit. And then you have, in Reaper's Gale, you have characters who are kind of standing on the border between these two peoples. They're kind of struggling when dealing with the Letheri. They kind of still have their, I don't know, can you call it Edur honor, maybe? And so I think that makes it so hard to really judge them. And what you also need to consider is that they can be pretty cruel, or have always been cruel to others, if you look at the slaves, for example. And you can see that through the perspective of Udinas. So, but then on the other hand, you have people like Trollsengar, then you have in Reaper's Gale, Bruthen Trana, and what was the other guy? Brolhandar, I think. Who again have some sympathetic aspects about them. So you can't really say that they're all bad or all good. They're just such a morally gray people. I mean, yeah, gray. The Edur are gray, so it kind of fits, I guess. So yeah, that's kind of...
I really agree. I remember reading some salty commenter once calling them like drow, like the D&D race, and I found it very unfair. I just think they're much more morally complicated.
Yeah.
And I agree. And you know, when we're talking about, you know, criticisms of their society, it does remind me there is this weird element where, you know, clearly they're like somewhat patrilineal. I don't really know, and it's like obviously it's somewhat different. I think the Nerek patriarchy is talked about, but it's not really explored, you know. I don't know, it's something I don't understand, but, you know, I don't know. I agree. There are more complicated people than that, and I definitely agree with what you're saying about the leaders thing. I think it's, and sometimes I just wonder if it's like a storytelling thing. I feel like definitely the Tists like have like a dude, and it's like, this is, you know, their dude, and this is the Andes dude, and, you know, I don't know. There's like larger than life heroes for each of them.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. The dragons. They tend to be dragons, right? Their leaders. With the exception
of
Hulad.
So Ruthann, how do you feel about the Edur, and how do you feel about this book as a, I don't know, would you call this book a prequel? You know, some insane people in my mind, truly insane people, say you should start with this book.
Well, I would say all of us who finished the 10 books have pretty much a little bit of insanity in us.
Agreed.
In terms of where you start, of course, this cannot be the starting point. But that being said, I've never really tried it. I can't see how it would work. The only possible reason that you might ask someone to start the series is because you think that simply because it's a clean slate, it can substitute as a first book. That simply because it's a new location and a new storyline that it would substitute. But that can't happen. And the reason is because, Peter, I'm not too sure if you've seen the first collaboration that A.P. Canavan and Philip Chase made about Gardens of the Moon.
Watched a bit, didn't finish it.
Right, so A.P. made an excellent point there about the reason for Erickson having to ship locations for different books. Because he said, look, if you were doing a 10-book series on the Second World War, what would you have to do? You couldn't set them all in one place. You would need one book that focused on the sort of the Middle East campaign. You would need one book that focuses on the anti-colonial movements that were fueling the Second World War. You would need one that talks about the European political dynamic with the rise of the Nazis and the fascists. You would need one book on how the United States under Roosevelt entered the Second World War. You would have to talk about the competition between all the empires in Africa, which fueled both the First and the Second World War. So when you have a story that spans the entire world, you will need different books that cover different locations. But that doesn't necessarily mean that a new start can be your actual start. Gardens of the Moon had to be the first one, because even though we criticize Gardens of the Moon for not having enough exposition, when you reread it, you will find that there is a lot of exposition
in
Gardens of the Moon.
Yeah.
There is, and at least sort of in terms of us getting the basics of the magic system, of the political system, Lassine's betrayal of, I mean, there's a scene where Shadow Throne and Cotillion talk about Lassine's betrayal and how much they sort of hate Lacine, right? That's exposition. The two of them already know that they hate Lacine. Cotillion doesn't have to tell Shadow Throne in front of us as the reader, oh, you're too obsessed with revenge or whatever. That in the beginning of Gardens of the Moon was just to sort of establish for us some of the underlying storylines that would go on and on. But in terms of your question on what I think of Reaper's Gale as a sequel to Midnight Tides,
So
do you feel that the Edur became a little one-dimensional in the book? Was that your problem?
No, I don't think it's that. I think I was just like, this book is so defined. I don't know. I felt so invested in the Edur story that I, like, the whole seventh book could have just been about them. I didn't need any of the other stuff, you know? So then, you know, because the seventh book's not just about the Edur, right? So many other, you know, so many plot lines are coming into the continent. So I feel like I kind of wished I spent more time with the characters that I had grown to love so much. And I think just that book's about something different, you know, kind of mismatched expectations in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. I get what you mean. And I suppose the reason for that is because Reaper's Gale is all about an inversion of power. So throughout Reaper's Gale, you have a number of different dynamics where one side thinks they have power over another, but in reality, it's the other way around. So Kasa and the Cripple God, where the Cripple God thinks he's manipulating Kasa, but Kasa just tells the Cripple God to go fuck himself in the end. Icarium and Tarlac Veed, where Tarlac Veed thinks he's the one manipulating Icarium as his friend, but Icarium just abandons everything and walks away in the end. The video that I made on Tanil Yatvana and Janath, where he thinks he has power over her, but she's the one who starts playing mind games with him. You can draw that same pattern with the Tees-Tidur and the Kingdom of Leather. Reaper's Gale was all about how, even though the Edur have now conquered the Kingdom of Leather, it's Lethary politics and the Lethary way of life that still has power over the Edur. The Edur might think that militarily they have conquered the Kingdom of Leather, but they are the ones who've been swallowed by this giant kingdom.
I definitely agree, and I think that's a great analysis you presented there, kind of echoing that video you made. And I think it's because what you're kind of touching on, which is such a central pillar to this book, is that, like, kind of the Lethary way of life is defined by an economic use of power from one or the other, right? It's about exercising economic control over others, be it through colonialism, imperialism, or just through a hyperized form of capitalism. And I'm really curious about why you think this book is somewhat so dedicated to this exploration of power. What do you think, Counselor? Why is this the volume to tackle economic expression of power?
The simple answer, I guess, is just because of the Lethar Empire, or the Lethary Empire, because they are this society that is ruled by money. And we get to follow several individual Lethary who seem to be only interested in their personal gain and are willing to do morally despicable things just to get more money. And I think it's also kind of a deconstruction of that empire that we get on the one hand with Tehol, who is... Teol seems to be the only Lethary who is not interested in money at all, even though he could be the richest person in the whole empire. And yeah, I mean, he is in the end, but he doesn't use that money for himself. He actually wants to change the way things go and kind of get rid of that rule of money and enable a better living for the poorer people. And in the end, he also succeeds with that. And I think the Edur, they are kind of swallowed by this Lethary way of living. But then you have people like Kasa Orlong coming in, who is also... I mean, maybe the parallel you could draw between Kasa and the Edur is that they both seem to be kind of savages, but Kasa is like on a even more primal level of being like Kasa Orlong the barbarian, and he does not, he is not overwhelmed by the Lethary. He finds them despicable. He is totally not okay with what they're doing, and he also is not okay with what the Edor are doing. So there is this scene where the those Tist Edor that have been imprisoned in the ships and then later in Letharus are released. And then Karsa, he swears vengeance for those people because he says, okay, you're doing that to your kin and you call me the barbarian. So, and then Karsa in the end is the one who brings down the emperor. So yeah, I don't know if that was answering your question, but that was kind of what came to my mind here.
I think it's kind of interesting we're talking about Reaper's Gale so much, but not too surprising since obviously these two books are integrated in major ways, right? And it brings me to this question. You know, my friend Johan, good guy, I like him, but he just is getting to Reaper's Gale and he's talking to me, he's reading the series for the first time, and he's like, I'm enjoying Reaper's Gale, but part of me really feels like I don't know why we had to do Midnight Tides. You know, couldn't we have just skipped this book and showed up to Letharus and just like, you know, we didn't need the backstory. Do you know what I mean? And I think this, you know, I understand his point, you know, and it's going to be a matter of, you know, your point of view, whatever. But I think it's getting to what you're getting at. I'd like to hear your thoughts on his thought. But I think it's kind of what you mentioned about this AP Canavan thing about, you know, what is it? What is the story here? Do you know what I mean? Because if the story is about getting to the crippled god and we're going to the glass desert and we're all, you know, we're all Tavor and Bupa, you know, then sure. Yeah, maybe I don't know if we needed this. You know, I get this argument. Do you mean if it's about the destination, you know? But is it really about that? Because if that's what it's about, I don't know if Gardens of the Moon is the place to start. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, I think it gets into this question about what do you do when you spend 3 million words, 10 huge novels? You know, is this really about getting to the single point at the end of the story? You know, I don't know. I think it's going to be a matter of how you think about it. And I wonder what you think about it, Counselor.
So I don't think it's about the destination. I think the journey is such a big part of the series. And if you're just here for the destination and just want to find out what the ending is about, then I don't think you're going to love the series because you need to care about the way to the destination. And I think that Midnight Tides is totally necessary because I think if you would have just jumped in into that storyline with a Reaper's Gale, we wouldn't have gotten all that set up. And then this clash and the intertwining of the Letheri and the Edor would be way less. It would have way less weight to it, I guess. And then also Midnight Tides presents us with that backstory of the crippled god and the sword and how Rulat got it, which I think is also really important. And it presents us with the backstory of Trull and what happened here, how he got, you know, outlawed by his people. So I think if Midnight Tides would not have been there, then Reaper's Gale just wouldn't be the same. So, yeah. And I personally, on my first read through, I enjoyed Midnight Tides more than Reaper's Gale because it just has a better flow, I guess. I think Erickson once said himself that Midnight Tides is the book that basically wrote itself. And I think you can feel that. Yeah. Reaper's Gale is a book that is a lot more work to get through. But I think in order to appreciate that work, you need that foundation that Midnight Tides sets.
I really agree. And I don't know. I understand his opinion. Obviously, I don't agree with my friend's thought. But I think it's because if you think about the stories about Tavor getting to the glass desert and defending the, you know, if like that's what the story's about, then sure. You know, why don't we just start with, you know, why don't we start with the army when they're there? I mean, but like,
it's quite a slippery slope as well. Because once we start doing that, you could use that same logic to argue that the Shaik rebellion was pointless. We could argue that
exactly.
The Panion Domin revolt was pointless. Once we start looking at whether these major set pieces were important for the final objective in the Kolan's Desert, then every major plot line collapses. If we were to start using, it's a very slippery slope, if you ask me.
No, I really agree. And I think it's just because, but the thing is, I do get it somewhat, but like, it's because ultimately it's coming down to like, what is the story about?
It's an anthology.
And exactly. In some ways, it really, I wouldn't go as far as to say it's an anthology, but it's really channeling a lot of that same energy. I mean, what Garden of the Moon is about is only related to what Book 10's about in like thematic and, some structural ways. I mean, I guess they mention some of the stuff, but I don't know.
I guess a crossover would be a better word for it. That's what I like using. It's kind of like the Marvel crossover where you might have individual Iron Man and Captain America stories, and there might be weekly issues that they print out where there are larger plot lines with many different characters from the Marvelverse participating. So that's always the way that I approach the series.
No, definitely. And it just gets into this fundamental question, and we should move on then. It's just like, what do you do when you spend 3 million? Like, what are 10 huge books? Do you mean, are they really related? How are they related? What's the relationship to one another? But now, Counselor, I really agree with what you said in some ways. I don't know about you guys. When my first way through the series, I think this was my favorite book. I think I was head over the heels with it. And I think it's because, as I said, I just really connected with it. And I was able to I was able to grasp it so well the first time through. And Ruth, before you got on the call, me and Counselor were talking about how much Toll the Hounds kind of shines on a second read through, because she was talking about her read through on her channel. And yeah, I wonder, for me, revisiting Midnight Tides, I think in some ways, some of the shine came off it in a way, And I wonder, Ruthann, you've said you revisited a little. Counselor, I know you've reread it. And I wonder how you guys feel like rereading the books kind of changes your perspective from your first experience, because I feel like often they're pretty different experiences rereading them.
Because we've just been talking about the journey and the destination, I think what has changed for me a little is that it's more about the journey on reread. And I feel like when I was reading it for the first time, I was sometimes rushing through a little bit too much. And I feel like I was reading those books really quickly. I think Iskar has also said that he had that issue when he read it for the first time, that he just read them so quickly. And then in the end, like, what was that? I need to reread that. And I think I was having that same issue, and a lot of things I just overlooked and didn't appreciate. And also, I wasn't that well read in fantasy back then. And I think now on reread, I'm reading the books a lot slower and I'm picking up a lot more. And so that's on the one hand a positive thing, but then on the other hand, I feel like this crazy enthusiasm of, I have to get to the end now. I need to know what's going to happen to my favorite characters. It's not really there quite as much anymore. So on the one hand, it's a lot more deep and worthwhile, I guess. But then on the other hand, it's sometimes a little bit more, not dull, but I don't know, the craziness, the initial craziness about the series has worn off a little, if that makes sense.
No, I get you. I feel you.
I was going to say, I sort of, when you guys were talking about how you like Midnight Tides more than Reaper's Gale, I was on board with that during my first read-through. When I finished the 10 big books, I did place Midnight Tides higher than Reaper's Gale. But as a rereader, I would have to put Reaper's Gale on a higher pedestal than Midnight Tides, because I just feel that Reaper's Gale has a lot more in terms of stuff to dissect and analyze and sort of jump into over and over again, think about it from different angles. For the type of stuff that I like in my fiction, I would say Reaper's Gale has rewarded me a lot. The reason I don't read Midnight Tides, reread Midnight Tides that often, is because while there are things there that I find enjoyable to revisit over and over again, it's certainly not on the same level as Reaper's Gale for me. I've read, I did not like Reaper's Gale that much the first time. I've got to be honest. Reaper's Gale was probably in my...
Me too. It's one of my least favorite my first time through. I'm really excited to revisit it for that reason, because as I mentioned to you, I think I kind of had mismatched expectations and I really thought, like, time to follow the eater up, and it's just not that
So
book.
I was just going to say, perhaps looking at Reaper's Gale as a sequel to Midnight Tides is perhaps wrong, because while it might be set in the sort of same continent or whatever, I think a lot of people who are disappointed in the follow-up probably expected Reaper's Gale to be a sequel for Midnight Tides rather than Reaper's Gale being part 7 in 6 books and multiple different plot lines and storylines that are now converging. Because if you think about it, Kasa arriving in Kingdom of Leto, the bridge burners arriving, many different things that have been built up in previous books converge in books 6 and 7.
No, dead on. And I think if in some ways that, you know, I don't know. I think at the end of Bone Hunters, it's kind of silly to say, was like the first time, and I feel like a lot of people feel this way, you're like, I kind of get it. I get what we're doing, and I get where we're all going. You know, we're all going to Letharus. This, we're doing it. Do you know what I mean? Maybe all of the characters will be in one book at the same time, you know? But this does, I jive with that, what you said there, Ruthann, in that, like, I feel like some of the shine came off the apple, too, when I reread Memories of Ice. You know, a book I think is a good book. You know, I'm not trying to smirch it or anything. But I think about a book like Gardens of the Moon or House of Chains, both books that I don't particularly like. And in fact, I was pretty critical of on the show in some ways. However, I think I would almost rather reread those books than reread this book, because I feel like I'm just like still chewing on it, or I'm just like, I'm trying to get my head around it, or I'm trying to look at it like at a different angle and kind of just think about it in a different way, where part of me feels like, you know, I kind of jived with it. I don't know how, like, if I reread this a third time, I think I'd get a little more, but I don't know how much more I can wring out of this towel. I don't know if you feel that way at all, counselor.
Yeah, kind of. So first of all, I also wanted to say what Ruthann has been saying about Midnight Tides and Reaper's Gale, I do agree with that. And now on reread, I wouldn't really say that I enjoyed Midnight Tides more. As I said, it's an easier read and Reaper's Gale was more work. But I think on reread, Reaper's Gale was a lot more rewarding and it had so much more to unpack about it with those storylines like Carus Invictat, for example, all that stuff that is so brilliant and everything going on in the Leather Empire. And I really didn't appreciate that the first time. So I think Reaper's Gale has really risen in my estimation of how good it is. So, yeah, as to the shine coming off, yeah, I get what you mean. I kind of, actually, before I was rereading Memories of Ice, I was actually a little scared to get into it because I was afraid that it wouldn't have that effect on me anymore, that overwhelming emotional effect, that it really crushes you. And it still hit me emotionally, but I just, probably it's what I said before, that intense enthusiasm, it's not really there anymore. And it's kind of replaced by me craving those deeper, you know, elements and storylines that you can really unpack that I didn't really see the first time because I was reading it on a more superficial level. So does that make sense?
No, I definitely... I'm grokking with what you're saying, yeah.
It made sense to me.
Okay, great.
You know, in some ways, we're kind of doing a little companion thing, talking about, you know, Reaper's Gale and Midnight Tides, you know, because they are pretty interrelated in some ways. But something I do think that is great, and then I want to broaden the conversation away, is that I do think this book is one of Erikson's most self-contained. Do you know what I mean? Like, pretty much by the end of the book, you know, I know it's technically, I don't know, but, like, I think all of the books are self-contained in some ways, but I feel like especially at this one, you know, it's a complete thought. It's an end of a sentence. We get to a period. And although, you know, Fear and, you know, that whole crew was going off and, you know, trolls, I don't know. Don't you agree? Isn't it kind of like a, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like Erikson does try to sort of insist often that all the books are self-contained in a way, except books 9 and 10. But I don't see how someone could just read The Bone Hunters, for instance, and say, oh, yeah, that was a standalone book, even though there is a typical start, middle, and end. But yes, this is probably the closest that any of the, maybe Gardens of the Moon, right? But other than Gardens of the Moon, this is the closest that anything gets to a self-contained story, because as you said, we see, we enter the story when things are calm. We are there along with the journeys, with the characters' journeys as things go haywire. We watch the war, and then we see the resolution of the war as well. So, and even though we don't really see the future with Rulard now being the king, other than perhaps some of the earlier books like Memories of Ice, where we get a clear resolution to the Panion Domin threat as well, there are only a couple of books that give us that resolution. And Midnight Tides is certainly one of them.
Yeah, and I always think that comment, I always think about it in almost a television sense, you know, like you were going to end the episode of television and we feel like we did it. I watched a full story, you know, and I feel like in most of the books you put them down and you're like, you know, that was it. We did it, you know. But, you know, we're talking about a relationship a lot with Reaper's Gale, but, you know, in a big picture thing, you know, I wonder what you guys think about it falling into the scope of the whole series, you know? And I know we talked about it, and I think we're all in agreement it's essential, and this idea you could cut it is, I don't know, Johan's welcome to his opinions, but...
He's right. He does have a point when he says that Reaper's Gale, right, does not really function as in that Midnight Tides as a book. When we look at it, once you finish the, I wonder what your friend's going to say once he's done with the series, because once he's done with the series, that feeling will probably grow. This feeling of why did we have Midnight Tides will probably grow, because we don't really see them doing much beyond Reaper's Gale either. In fact, Bryce is there almost as a tokenistic character in the final battle.
In my opinion, I would have rather Bryce just, you know, I don't know. I didn't need him in the finale. But anyway,
yeah.
Continue.
So that entire plot goes nowhere with the final Kolan's battle. Whereas with the other forces, we see the Jagut there, we see the Aimas there, we see the Kachin Chamal there. There are many plot points that converge, and we see Bryce there as well, representing the sort of Lethary storyline or whatever. And there's a small cameo from Tihol, I think right at the beginning of Dust of Dreams. But once your friend is done with all 10 books, his sort of his point is only going to be stronger in his mind.
No, I agree. Like, he's not wrong. I understand his point. I just like the book too much, you know. I don't know. But what I was getting at is I do wonder what you think about where it falls in the series as a whole in terms of pacing and in terms of themes. I don't know. Like, when you think about this book, what do you think about in terms of the big scope, Counselor?
Ooh, that's actually not that easy of a question.
No, it isn't.
So my spontaneous thought here is that what is kind of a parallel to other books is that of convergence, kind of that you have two different sides whose storylines kind of get intertwined. I mean, you have that element in several of the other books as well. So you have in Gardens of the Moon, you have Darutistan versus the Malazans. Then you have the whole apocalypse thing on Seven Cities. Then you have the Alliance versus the Panion Domin. And then in Midnight Tides, you have the Lethary versus the Tistidor. And I think that Midnight Tides is the last book that kind of has that clear this group versus that group story going on. And then afterwards, with Bone Hunters and then Reaper's Gale and onwards, it's kind of where several storylines start to converge. And it's getting harder and harder to kind of say, yeah, this is what it's about. We have this group and then that group and they're fighting. So I think what Midnight Tides is doing, it's presenting us with that last piece of setup with that kind of structure. And all of that structure is kind of a foundation that's important to understand the overall evolution that is going on in the series, because I personally always felt like the series portrays a world that is going through a transformation and kind of an age is done, the book must close in the end. So, and in order to really understand that transformation, you need that foundation that is presented to us through the first five books. So, yeah, I guess that's kind of my answer. So it kind of presents us with that setup that we got in Chernabakis and Seven Cities through the first four books with this two group. Yeah, I don't know. This one group versus the other. I don't know.
No, I think that's a great point. And I've never really thought about it that way, that I, you know, this is definitely, I don't know, I guess towards the end, maybe there is a bit of a this team versus that team type of thing. But I don't know. It's definitely different, especially in a book like this, where it's so delineated between the two major plot lines. And even in a book like Toll the Hounds, where there is a major delineation, it's not really about, you know, it's just kind of two different settings. The fact that, you know, they're not against each other or anything. Ruthann, what do you think of the question? Big scope, big picture.
Yeah, so as far as Midnight Tides goes, if I was to just give it a regular rating like I would with any other book, I would say it's an excellent book. As in, if I was to go on a sort of Goodreads or Amazon type page, I would still give it 5 stars or whatever the maximum rating is, because I think it's an excellent book. However, if the question is, where does it stand in the sort of the pantheon of books? Where does it stand in the context of the larger series? I have to admit that it's not one of my favorites, right? Because since I've revisited most of the other books many times, Midnight Tides has come down a lot. There are a couple of books like House of Chains and Reaper's Gale and even Dust of Dreams that I would have put below Midnight Tides the first time I read the series, which I now put ahead of Midnight Tides. That would be so, because other than Tehol and maybe Iron Bars, I can't think of too many other characters and storylines that I would look forward to actively going in and reading again. So when I think of Midnight Tides, I think about the sort of all the economic stuff, the empire stuff, the Tehol stuff, the Edur sort of power struggle and all that. But ultimately, I think, you know, it's okay. In the context of the larger 10 books, I would say it's not one of my personal favorites.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm really interested to see in it. You know, I'm obviously my first reread is like on the show and everything. So it's kind of interesting to revisit some of these books, and as I'm saying, and I feel like by the end, you know, I feel like I'm going to end up putting, I don't know, I already think Toll the Hounds is now my favorite, but I just feel like, as you're saying, just some of those other books are going to squeak out ahead of a book like Midnight Tides, which, as you're saying, I like this book a lot. You know, I'm extol its virtues all day. But, you know, I think an important element of this book, when I think about it in the grand scope of the series, is that I do think in some ways, you know, I know we have the Penny and Domin and, you know, we have the apocalypse and all this, but I think this is a much more meaningful representation of the crippled god at, like, I was going to say the height of his power, but that's not really the phrase I would use. But, you know, having a very meaningful influence, you know, and what does it mean to, like, what does this power mean, and how is his power being used? And like, what is your relationship to being kind of being seduced or corrupted or trying to use this power for your own will? You know, I don't know. I think about it as being kind of the most meaningful exploration of a relationship between the crippled god and one of his followers, you know. Because the other ones that we get, you know, I don't know, they don't do much for me compared to some of those scenes between Rulad and the crippled god and the relationship between the crippled god as a whole and the Edur people.
It's interesting that you say that, because to me, I always thought that the crippled god became interesting only at the end of Reaper's Gale, when he begs Kasa to take the sword, and Kasa just tells him to get lost. And by the time we get to Toll the Hounds, we do see that his personality is a lot softer and a lot more sympathetic now, for whatever reason. And by the time we get to Dust of Dreams and the Crippled God, as I've said in one of my videos before, we find out that he is the damsel in distress that we are here to save. So to me, the Crippled God, because if you look at his relationship with the sword maker in Midnight Tides, I'm actually quite fascinated that you would say that, that it was a meaningful exploration of his personality. Because to me, I didn't really see much there other than what Erikson had already led me to believe, because Erikson had already fooled me into believing that this guy was going to be the big antagonist of the series because of the Crippled God and House of Chains. And I was just completely reeled in. I had swallowed the bait hook, line, and sinker. And when I was reading book, I just saw the Crippled God as this big evil force that had to be defeated.
You know, interesting to say that. I mean, how do you feel, Counselor?
What I like about the Crippled God in Midnight Tides is that we get to see his involvement a lot more with Rulat, and also Rulat, I guess, he's also kind of reflecting the Crippled God maybe a little bit when you see how tormented he really is, and he's in a situation which he cannot escape, which is also true for the Crippled God. And when I was reading the series for the first time, I thought that the Crippled God is the antagonist as well, but I did feel some sympathy for him, because I don't know, there was just something about this guy sitting in his tent, and he's pretty sick all the time, and I kind of felt sorry for him. And I had been wondering, has anybody ever tried to extend a friendly hand to him and just be nice to him? What would happen then? And nobody ever does that. And then in the end, when we find out that it's actually about saving the Crippled God, that was a little bit of a confirmation to me, because I thought, they should have just been nice to him. And I really enjoyed that whole story element of the Crippled God and the sword and Rulat and everything. And also to see Rulat's descent into madness, I think that's it's so heart-wrenching, honestly, because he was a little bit of a bratty teenager. He was not a likable character in the beginning, but he did not deserve what was happening to him. And I felt incredibly sorry for him. So, and then by the end of Reaper's Gale, you have realized that Rulat is just, a poor guy in a horrible situation. And the same is true for the Crippled God as well. So,
agreed about Rulat. I mean, fascinating character in some ways, but, in some ways, isn't he just like a boy, but as you're, I think maybe we will disagree on that, Ruthon. I will agree in some ways. I don't think like the books about the Crippled God in Midnight Tides is, or it's like that complicated of a portrayal or anything. But I think this is the start of understanding him more, of him being a little more sympathetic. And I definitely think his relationship with Rulat is much more fleshed out than his relationship with the Apocalypse or the Paninian Domain, where I feel like in those two, he's definitely like, oh no, there's the big bad god and he's really bad and it feels like that's really where those feelings that we're talking about on your first read, where you're like, this guy sucks, like originates from kind of those images of the god.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is also perhaps because Rulat is the first tool that he uses where the entire power base is his. So when he uses the Paninian Domain in Memories of Ice, that guy's a Jarguth already. Those guys are sort of strong enough to beat the shit out of anybody they see, essentially. And with House of Chains, he uses Shaik. The Whirlwind is a Tulan Aimas, Onrak's wife. Onrak's wife, who has been jilted, that Onrak picked Kilava over him, and she's just turned into this sort of a specter of revenge or whatever. That's what the Whirlwind in Raraku is. So with the previous quote-unquote antagonists that we see, while they do draw, while the cripple god does use them as tools, their power base is not completely his. Roulard is the first real, once again, quote-unquote, antagonist that we see, who was breeded entirely by the cripple god. The emperor, that the emperor on the throne, the unkillable emperor with the sword that we see, is entirely the cripple god's creation, which is not something that we can say with all the other major threats that we faced in previous books. But I mean, come on, is he really the most sympathetic character though, Roulard? Is he really?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if he's the most sympathetic, but I agree in that I think, I don't know, he's definitely a bad dude, you know? Like, obviously, him being in a bad situation doesn't make him not responsible for all
this
stuff.
If we look at the horrible things that happen to Tok, if we look at the horrible things that happen to sort of Beak, if we look at, there are so many characters in the series whose lives are just a tragic series of just one miserable thing after another. Does Roulard really belong in that top sympathetic sort of group?
I don't know. What do you think, Counselor? I know how I feel.
So I think that Roulard appears a little bit more gray than Tok, for example. As to what they went through, that's debatable whose fate was more horrible. They both had to suffer a lot, I guess. I mean, Tok, my poor boy. And I think with Roulard, it's easy to see him as pathetic because he, when you have that imagery of him like crying and just being in complete despair, and then yet just when he is reborn and he just lies there screaming and everything, you just think, it's easy to think, yeah, he's just such a pathetic guy. Just, can he not be better, stand up, do something? And especially when the way you've gotten to know him in Midnight Tides, where he's this bratty teenager who is like making eyes at his brother's future wife and everything, that doesn't really make him sympathetic. So, but I think what we need to consider here is that in order to feel compassion, yes, I've mentioned the word compassion, a character doesn't need to be sympathetic, I guess. In Reaper's Gale, for example, I even felt compassion for Karas Invictad, who is not a great guy, like really not at all. So because you have been saying that, is Ruthan really the most sympathetic guy? No, absolutely not. But that doesn't mean that I can't feel for him.
Yeah, I agree. And I especially agree with your point about Tok.
Okay, so why don't we, let's put this to test then, this whole idea of what a sympathetic character Roulard is. Let's just put it to test, right? Compare that with the person the cripple god used before Roulard, the Panian seer, the Panian domain. That is a sympathetic character. A kid who was caught in the middle of a genocide. The mass murderers were coming after his mother. They killed his mother in front of him. He escaped with his sister. And the two of them were caught for thousands of years in this this warren of chaos or whatever. He comes back under the control of the cripple god and he does all this. And then we find out that he's just the guy who wants to take care of his sister. That to me is a much more sympathetic character than as Counselor was saying, a bratty teenager who makes eyes at his brother's wife or whatever.
Yeah, and I listen, you know, I maybe wires getting crossed in some ways. I don't know. I mean, like, obviously I have tremendous sympathy for Tok. Do you know what I mean? Let's like take him as you used. Like, you know, and same thing with Ditto with Opinion, and like, you know, but my sympathy for Tok and everything is uncomplicated. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, yeah, that must have been really bad. Feels bad for Tok. Feels bad to read about it. He goes through so much. And every time you're like, man, again, it's fucking Job over here, you know? And like, you know, I don't know. So yeah, you know, but when we get to the Roulard thing, this is what I think is more compelling, right? Because it's, for me, it's much more compelling to read about than the Tok stuff, because it's really pressing me. And I know, and listen, maybe some people have less, you know, for the him being a bit of a brat, right? But like, you know, Because obviously he's a bad dude in a lot of ways, right? And just like straight up bad, a lot of ways, does a lot of bad stuff, you know? But it's like pressing me, I think, more on like, how far does this go? And like, how are you actually willing to feel about him? While he's, you know, there is these sympathetic elements to him, but he's a much worse dude. And, you know, where, you know, I don't know. Of course I feel bad for, I mean, I think I'm more drawn to this trying to process how I actually feel, even if it results in me ranting for 30 minutes and not getting anywhere. But I feel like I'd rather chew on that than just be like, man, Tok's having a bad time,
yeah,
isn't
that,
he?
Yeah, that's a valid point.
Yeah. Not that, you know, it always gets weird when you're comparing who's having a worse time. Not that that's a thing we can really do, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and what has been making me really sad when rereading Reaper's Guild is that Rulat doesn't really get a chance to change again, because I mean he was a teenager, so technically he's still almost a kid when all of that happens to him, and he would have had a lot of time in front of him or before him to just change and become a better person. And but that doesn't happen, because then the whole crippled god and sword and a thousand deaths stuff happens to him, and then in the end he just dies. And I think that is really sad, because he could have behaved differently in the beginning, but then he didn't get a chance to undo what he was doing wrong.
No, I agree, and we gotta wrap up soon, but I don't know about you guys. I think that's part of the reason we keep talking about Reaper's Gale, where I think I was kind of disappointed in Reaper's Gale, because I found his death to be a bit of a letdown, especially with how invested I was in that character. So I don't know. I don't know how else I wanted it to end. Of course, maybe he had to die in some ways, but yeah, you're right in that he is, you know, I don't know. In some ways, he is defined by his adolescence. We even talk about the late adolescence of Eater early on in Midnight Tides.
Yeah, that troll's a virgin.
Yeah, troll is a virgin. He talks about it next to the turtle. What a legendary scene. Anyway, listen, everybody, that's going to do it for us today on the show. You should check out both Ruth Ann and Counselor's YouTube channels. There'll be a link in our description, and you can find them on the YouTube.com, as the kids say. And you should check out their videos. They've been putting them up pretty recently, and, you know, good stuff, good stuff. And as I said, I just love having more voices in the community. And, you know, more the merrier is my two cents. And listen, we got five more books, so hopefully they'll be you know, back soon enough, you know? I mean, in a few months, we'll be doing Bone Hunters. Let us know what you think of the show at We're 10 Very Big Books and Gmail and Twitter, and any closing thoughts from you two?
No, it was a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been really nice chatting with you guys, and yeah.
That's awesome.
And you can cut this out if you want to, but I like how Erickson's probably going to be sitting through over an hour of this discussion, hoping for us to start talking about the things that he tried to kind of make us to pit us against each other about, and let him just sit through a 70-minute discussion, and there's nothing about what he wants us to discuss.
Not a single thing. You can't provoke us, Steve. Nice try.
Not biting, Steve. Sorry.
All right, everybody. Let's do it again sometimes. A great talk, and goodbye, everybody.